Alrighty, so I just wanted to give you a little bit of, not yet, it's on.
During the presentation.
We might use it.
Okay.
As a speaker. So I just wanted to share with you the little brief journey of kind of how all this has panned out. We actually live in South Central Oklahoma. You can make it in 3.5 hours. Yesterday we made it in about 5 hours and 15 minutes. So anyway, that was a whole other experience. But so this is a picture back in 2003. The kid with that big cucumber or whatever over his head is standing right here, and his actually sister is actually there in the back of the room. But we this was our experience with moving to the country and starting to grow vegetables, and you can see it looks pretty pitiful, and it was pretty pitiful. Okay, but the thought is that our idea of gardening was basically putting in a few raised beds and killing produce. That was kind of how was our idea of gardening. But anyway, it was quite a little journey. This actually is when Alan found a book, and is this before that?
No, you're right.
Alan, we were visiting my mom in Keene, Texas, so I grew up in this area. This area is home for me, and there was a Black & Decker gardening book in her garage, and he actually is thumbing through it, and he started looking at pictures, and he's going like, Dad, look how pretty these pictures are of this produce. Why does our produce never look like this? And so, of course, I had no idea. I think the standard answer was, we live in Oklahoma and you can't grow stuff like that in Oklahoma. Okay? So, but he kind of got into this thing. And so you can see the garden, the boxes are still there, right? Those were those earlier from several years ago that lay dormant for several seasons. But this was kind of his first little take at getting started. And this was when he was about, I think, about 13, 14 years old. Okay, so this is actually, we moved from that location and we moved to this new place in 2018. And so this is a few years ago of what our market garden looked like, in essence, the first year we got started there. Now, the journeys that you didn't see was every year on that other piece of land that we had, the garden would grow a little bit. And it would grow a little bit more.
And it would grow a little less.
Yeah, and it would grow a little bit more, and a little bit more. And over time, after growing there for, that was 2009, remember? So that was a 9-year journey from that little garden you saw there to this in 2018. So we're going to talk about, as we made this move and transition into this idea of market gardening, what, looking back on it, what are some things that we felt like were really critical keys to be able to go from there to something like this. You with me? Okay, so hopefully you're in the right class. Alan, you want to add anything before we go? Okay. So this is our family. We all live on the farm. My in-laws, this is my wife's folks. They're originally from Colombia, South America, and they have an amazing story about their whole lives and coming to the States and all those types of things. There I am over on the right, my wife, Vivian. Of course, you see Alan. Our daughter here on the left is Aubrey. And Alan's wife of about a year and three or four months, who's in the back here, Skylar. So that's us and our dog. You'll see her more, the little dog there. That's our farm dog. And you'll see how important farm dogs are here. Just a second. Okay. I wanted to share with you a quick quote, and then we'll move right along. So let's read this. I'll just read it. You can kind of follow along. Farmers should not think that agriculture is a business that is not elevated enough for their sons, and I could even say daughters. Agriculture should be advanced by scientific knowledge. Farming has been pronounced, what? Unprofitable. People say that the soil does not pay for the labor expended upon it, and they bemoan the hard fate of those who till the soil. In this country, where she wrote this at the time, Australia, many have given up the idea that the land will pay for working it, and thousands of acres lie unimproved. But should persons of proper ability take hold of this line of employment and make a study of the soil and learn how to plant, to cultivate, and to gather in the harvest, more encouraging results might be seen. Many say, we have tried agriculture and know what its results are. And yet these very ones need to know how to cultivate the soil and to bring science into their work. And that was actually from Signs of the Time, August 13, 1896. Now, remember, how many people do you think today are involved in agriculture for a full-time occupation?
1%.
Hardly anyone, right? How many people do you think were involved in some way of agriculture in 1896?
80%.
Okay, so she's writing to these people. She's not writing to us. But you think about how much more important this is in our day. Because I'll be honest with you, my grandfather, my mom grows up in Oklahoma. I was telling somebody this at breakfast, I think, this morning. She grew up, no electricity in her house, no running water. But guess what they had? They had a big garden. My grandfather taught my mom. But when I came of age, I grew up in a very comfortable home. We never really had a garden. My generation was the generation that we kind of, everybody came off of the garden. And so all that knowledge was all, this is all back there, right? And so now here we are, running around trying to figure out what do we do, what do we do, how do we do this, how do we do this? And we oftentimes fail. Not that that's a problem. And we fail again, and we fail again. And then we come to the point where it's like, we have tried agriculture. And we know what the results are. So we have a tendency to just what? Give up. Right? We give up. And it's easy to do that. I can understand that. We can kind of, you know, some of the most emotional conversations we have are because of things that fail. And we just go, you know? But we'll talk more about that later. Not even today, maybe just a little bit. So this is a neat slide. I love this slide, okay? Because this is what people think success looks like. And that's what it really looks like.
Absolutely.
And you're going to see this slide again, I promise you. I use it in every one of my talks because you have to keep this mentality in your head. You just have to understand that you may be right here, but you may be right in here, you may be right in here. Few people are over here. Okay? And it takes, you just heard the Dysingers. If you were here in the last talk, Dysingers just talked about, they've been farming over 20 years. And the deer just basically ate all their strawberry plants. How can you let something like that happen? You've been farming for 20 years, what's wrong? Right? No. It's just things you don't see. All of a sudden, something happens that is shifted this year that was different. We never had an issue with deer before. That's what they said. We really never had that big an issue with it. But this year, something was different. And it happens like that. It just, things happen. And you learn and you move on. Okay? All right. So, Alan, you want to say anything about this? Okay. Very good. All right. So, here's the thing. I hope somebody took a picture of that, because having Alan speechless is pretty... No, just kidding. Okay, this is our farm dog. I just want to strike the importance of how important it is to have a really good farm dog. Okay? Just to tell you about our farm dog, unfortunately, we adopted this dog about a year and a half ago. She's about, I don't know, maybe 10 or so. She's deaf. And we can't let her out of our sight hardly when we're outside, because she just wanders off and you can't call her. She can't hear you. And I'm just thinking, like, this is not the right dog to have on the farm. I mean, you know, because we have hawks and stuff that fly by that would just, like, see her as an appetizer.
She's about this big.
Yeah, okay. She's a great dog. I'll show you how important those. She can come in here in just a second. Okay, this is key number one, soil, all right? Soil. Now, you can change the soil. You can manipulate the soil. But I'm going to have Alan walk us through this little idea behind one of the things we have on the soil. Do you want me to keep advancing?
Why don't you keep moving?
Okay, here we go. Now, if how many of you actually own land and you're at the point where you already own your land and you're just thinking whether you want to start to grow on it more seriously or you're growing on it already?
I already grown with it.
Okay. Are people here still looking for land? Anybody here actually considering to look for land? So, a handful. Okay, very good. This is very important. If you're still in the process of looking for land, or even if you have a lot of land and you're wanting to drill down on that particular part of land where you're thinking about growing, this is an amazing website. Please don't miss this. This is critical. We use this website on and on and on many, many times when trying to figure out where we were going to go. So
So let me just see what other soil.
So you just want to Google web soil survey. Okay, web soil survey.
Then it has this. Then it has this nice green button here, and you click the button, and it gives you a map of the United States. You can also look, I believe, at Alaska. But basically, what's happened? Your taxpayer dollars at work here. Basically, and this is still going on to a certain extent, but basically a lot of Eager Beaver Extension agents went across the entire United States, county by county, taking core samples down to 80 inches or the most restrictive feature, like a bedrock. And basically you can go to the land that you're looking at.
Okay, so we're going to go to our farm.
Yeah, so this is our farm.
Okay.
And then you create an area of interest. So basically it puts in the address so that it brings you close to where you want to select.
Yep.
Then you You create an area of interest by clicking this button right here, this square, or you can make a polygon, you know, if it's not a perfectly square property. And you basically do the perimeter of the property that you're interested in.
Right.
Then it gives you a soil map of your property, and the soil maps can either be different soil types or different grades of slope. So you can see the contour of the land. So for instance, this one is
take you to the next one.
Okay.
There you go.
Then it will tell you.
Here
it says 0 to 3% slope, 3 to 8% slope. So
this
you can
is,
actually
this
see.
This is the 40. This is. See up there, 40?
Okay.
This is describing that.
Yeah, number 40. Yeah. And then it gives you a description of the land. So overall elevation, precipitation, frost-free periods, the classification of the land. All areas are prime farmland. So there's two things that will affect whether it's considered prime farmland according to the USDA. One is if it's more than a 3% slope, because they're thinking tractors. So it doesn't mean you can't grow there, but if they're saying that if it's beyond this slope, it's really not safe for heavy equipment. And so that will be one thing that determines it. The other thing will be the shallowness or depth of the soil. Because obviously if your soil is this deep, you can't get a plow into it, so they're not going to consider it prime farmland. So if you see that it says prime farmland, usually the soil is going to be deep enough and it's within less than a 3% slope. And then it tells you here a topical profile down to 8 inches. So 0 to 8 inches is a fine sandy loam. Same thing for 8 to 16, 16 to 64 is a sand clay loam. And then 64 to 8 inches is fine. So basically, this particular soil is actually 29 feet deep to bedrock that we have. Basically, you're trying to look, because if it says 0 to 8 inches, fine sandy loam, and then it says 18, 16 inches bedrock, then you know that you don't even have to go look at that property. And then it also gives, it says it's a well-drained soil. It also says it's a runoff class is low. Basically, what this means is that if this was a clay soil, it means that the water wouldn't actually go through the profile. It would actually run off. So if it's a 0 to 3% slope, and it's, let's say instead it says low runoff class, let's say it said high runoff class, it means that you're really going to have to spend a lot of time and effort to make sure that land can drain, because it's just going to puddle on top or evaporate off. So this is good, considering the slope situation. The depth to water table, more than 80 inches. So if it says depth to water table, 12 inches, then you know that it's going to be hard for that soil to drain too. Frequency of flooding, none. That's a really important thing, because if you're going to build a house or you're going to try to get a loan on this property to build a house, they won't give it to you if it says frequently floods or occasionally floods. So you can actually see the historical flood potential of that land. Setting a foot on the property.
And keep in mind, that's only for a chunk of our property. That was only in the 40 area. Remember, we have three different types of sections that they survey for you. But here's the thing. If you're here today and you want to say, oh, I think I want to move to Tennessee, or I want to move to Oklahoma or wherever, and you have an address, you have an address for that property, you can go, you can do an area of interest on that, pull it up, and it tells you all this data about that land. Before you ever think about even going to look at it. This just will save you a huge amount of time.
And money.
And energy and effort, all that kind of stuff, okay? So I would just go. Now, another option you can do, if you're having difficulty getting on the web soil survey, you can do this trick. This is, of course, what we did. This is our soil test. Watch. See, that's how she tests the soil right there. Okay, very good. So that's that's why you want to have a farm dog in case you need to, you can't operate the computer, just use your farm dog. Okay, all right, now water. Let's go about this. Water is just so critical. Where is your water? Where are you going to get your water from? If you can't answer that question, you need to be very careful. You just need to be very, very, very careful. Now, you don't need tons of water, but you do need a pretty good water source. Now, here again, if you're, we're talking about a market garden here. If you're talking about buying land and you just want a small little garden in your backyard, then you probably don't need the kind of water you're thinking of if you're trying to do a market garden. You with me? Okay, so this is a picture. That was a day where Alan and I, after we left this scene, we had like this really bad feeling in our stomach. Because this was a picture that we paid this these guys $4,000 to come out and drill it well on some land that we'd made an offer on. We had not bought it yet, but we'd made an offer. And the offer was based upon if we could find 25 gallons of water, 25 gallons a minute of water or more, we would buy the land. Okay? So these guys came out, they drilled, they drilled, they drilled, and they got basically about 6 gallons of water a minute. So, we didn't buy
talk about your money going down a hole.
But think about how valuable that is for us to know that before we make this investment in buying this property, getting everything moved out there, trying to get things set up, right? You just want to, you need to know what's going on with your water. Just please, please. In fact, one of this guy here told us a story about a preacher that had built this house, but didn't drill for a well yet. Finished his house, finally came in to get water. He hasn't come out to drill his water. Can't find water. Can't find water. He said it's the most colorful he's ever heard a preacher talk in his whole life. Yeah. But, unfortunately, we maybe fall in love with the land because this was a beautiful little spot. I mean, Al and I were talking, oh, hey, this is where the fields could go. The house could go here. Oh, look over here. You know, until you're emotionally, you're getting invested in it. Yes?
Something else by us.
But you want to be praying about it and you want to put it. This was a fleece for us, I felt like. It was kind of an expensive fleece, but it was something we needed to know first. And so, anyway, just keep that in mind. That's one aspect of water. Now, where does your water flow? We actually have some areas on our land that even the Webb Soil Survey, I don't think, actually reflected totally perfect. And we got some big rain. Now, it only did this basically the second year we were on the farm. We've been there now 6 years. We haven't had this issue, but that second year, this is the issue we had. Look at this. Whoa. What do you think of that? How do you think your potatoes are going to do if you plant them right there? Not too bad. Yeah, right. Okay. Now, it hasn't looked like that again in 5 years. Now, amazingly enough, this was down in one kind of the northwest corner of our property where it can flood. Not huge flood. There's a lot of rain. But this is standing in 3 inches, 4 inches. And it was like this for several days. Okay, we didn't get the drip. Now, up here where we were planting, where we had all of our stuff planted at the time, because you can see the fence right there, you see, I don't know if you see it. That was all fine. We had a little puddling stuff, but it drains through, it did well. But, I mean, we were talking about getting, I don't know, this was probably 7, 8 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of water coming down.
So are those greenhouses yours also?
So unusual, yes.
Okay.
But it's unusual, right? So very unusual, but here again, if we would have had stuff planted there, we would have lost all of it. So now we're not planting it. We still don't have anything planted in those fields because we haven't opened it up. I'll show you a picture here in just a second. You'll see, get a better idea. But this is kind of taking another picture. I walked back around, took back this way, and you can just see plants just don't like that, right? They just don't like it. Now, it needs to drain well.
And we'll get it. We're probably going to get it to drain in the next few years, but it's going to be about $4,000 to $5,000 to bring a dozer in and get it worked out correctly.
We just need to get the water to flow off just a little bit.
And it doesn't need to flow fast. No. It just needs to flow.
No, it's okay if you have some standing water for a short period of time, but you don't want it there for days. It's just, yeah. Okay. Think close and cozy. So This is an idea. This is a key three. Hub and spoke. I'm going to shake you guys through. I don't want you walking through this. Do you remember?
So this is Mike Apple and...
I'm not interested in the
Okay. Farm. So this is a farm in Oklahoma that we went and visited.
Can I back up with one thing?
Sure.
So 9 years ago...
Nine years ago,
before the very first Ad Acre conference in Tennessee, was anybody there? Okay, we have a handful of people. Okay, very good. We took a trip. It was in November that year. Ad Acre was in November that year, I think. And we took a trip to go see farms. This was before we'd bought that other land I showed you. This is before we bought the bigger piece of property. You'll see. Okay. So we're wanting to go see farms and get an idea of the layout and the designs and stuff like this. So we went and visited, I think, 4 or 5 farms on this trip. Okay, so go ahead.
So this is one of the farms. So this is their house here. This is their growing area over here. Each of these beds are like 300 feet long, if I remember. They were really long. It was kind of a tractor operation. So, you know, you can say that's 300, 600, 800, well, sorry, 300, 600, 900. So, I mean,
1,200.
So, you know, you're looking at, what am I,
at least
a fifth of a mile?
I don't know.
Or something between their farthest field here. And then if you add this, right, you have to walk down here, walk all the way here. And then this is their pack house here. I mean, just the distance is just crazy.
So we weren't really thinking about that kind of stuff at the time, but as we visited more and more farms, it kind of became apparent one thing that seemed kind of critical. Okay, here's another farm.
So this farm is a similar situation. Their pack house is up here at the top, and they have fields all the way back here. I mean, with this farm, you really need golf carts and something to get around quick because it's such a distance between these two points. They're spending half of their day just walking.
If they're trying, yeah. And remember, you know, you're talking about some of these high-value crops, a lot of these fresh greens, a lot of this type of things that maybe people are growing. But if you're harvesting in June, July, August in the South, you're fighting. You got to be up really, really early in the morning or whatever. And then you're all this distance from, you know, on a wash pack houses, this is where you're taking your produce to wash it, to get it packed, to get it ready for market, those types of things, right? And we'll talk more about that in just a minute. But it just seemed like an awful long ways away. Okay, here we go. Here's another one.
Is this Coleman's?
Yeah.
So I don't know how scattered around this is. This is a little better.
Yeah.
Because this is his wash pack facility in the center here. And then he has fields on this side and fields on that side and here. So it's a little bit more central and serviceable.
Yeah, yeah. That was encouraging. Now look at this one here.
This is JM's farm.
You've just ruined it.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Sorry, what?
No, go ahead. Go.
Sorry.
I had a slide. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay. And as you can see, he has hardly any roadways here. Everything is condensed in, and he's right in the center of his hub. This is his irrigation pond, because they get a lot more rain up there. I don't think he has a well on this property. But it's just... I mean, you step out your back door and you're in your fields, and it's just so condensed, and you're spending more time actually doing stuff that's bringing profit than just trying to transport yourself to and from the fields.
Where's the house?
They actually live right
here.
There, and
oh,
then they're walking
back.
Yeah. And so, but the thing about what we really fell in love with in this concept of this farm was you walk out and you're just not that far from anything. I mean, you're just close. You have easy access. So you're not putting the pack house way over here and all the way over here. So this was actually the guy. His name's Gene Martin. Some of you maybe recognize a book he wrote. But we had an opportunity to go up, and he gave us a little tour of his farm and things of that nature.
We have this book at the Ad Agribusiness, by the way.
Yeah, and it just transformed kind of how we were thinking about what we never really thought about, that dynamic of the hub, right? And then you just have everything kind of centered around it. And it just... You know, he has it really tight there, really tight. Our place isn't so tight, but you'll get a sense that he inspired us quite a bit to do what we were going to be doing. So this is actually our farm now, okay? And so all that water that you saw in those pictures before was right down in this area. That's where we have our flooding issues still today. Obviously no water there right now, but heavy, heavy, heavy rains and things of this nature. So this picture was just taken a couple weeks ago, and... So it kind of gives you an idea, but our wash pack flights here,
our goal down the road is that you can see that we've got the crop piece fields. This is, after we get this water issue worked out, these will be additional fields like this up here. Mm-hmm. So we're here, so everything kind of surrounds it.
So from corner to corner of the farm, so like from here, the farthest corner you'd ever go to harvest, all the way to the other side is like within 450 feet.
Right, so I actually paced it. I decided, I'm going to walk.
Did?
Yeah, I walked out the front door from our wash pad. I walked this way, walked over here, and I walked to that back corner. And it was 150 steps. So, I mean, it's doable. It's just,
when you're condensing down in things, it just makes it so much more accessible. So I just feel like this is a really critical thing to think about when you're laying your farm out, because you're back and forth quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, you do, you know, so you're coming back.
Oh, I forgot that tool. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're like, wait, your tool shop's here, your garden place, trust me, you're back and forth more than you think you are. Mm-hmm.
And it just becomes a lot more time consuming. And that's just energy you're putting into to wasted time. That's the kind of wasted time. Yes.
You get enough. Do you talk about elevation?
No, not so much, not right here.
So one thing to think about too is like at Dysinger's farm, I don't know if they're here, but they're on the side of a slope of a hill. And so like in our minds, their pack facility is on top of their hill and they have to go down and bring stuff up. So they're going down empty and they're coming up loaded. So technically speaking, there's two options. One is to basically put your pack facility below your, so you're going up empty, coming down full, so gravity's working with you. Or invest in golf carts or something like that to basically level out your...
That's right.
Because not everyone's going to be able to find land that's a perfect 0 to 3% slope.
That's right. Okay, so keep beds close to seed house, wash pack house, right? I just mentioned this, 150 steps anywhere on our farm. And I'll tell you, it just makes your life a lot happier. It really does, because you're going to forget stuff. And, you know, we're getting better with packing up things and remembering what we need to do and what we take. Okay, so that's number. Okay, standardize. The key to save your time and your mind is to standardize. And I think everybody who first started out, I know the Dysingers mentioned it in their talk just before. We actually went through this learning curve. When we were at our other place, which was a much, much smaller garden area, we had different lengths of beds. Okay, so then you start, it's not that big a deal, but then you start cutting irrigation and you start doing all this. So we're going to go through the idea of why it's so important to standardize. Okay, so I just put this up. I know it's a lot going on here. How about I run through this one and you do the next one? Okay, so when we're talking about our plan, this is a field right here, okay? So this is field, we call this 1C, 2C, 3C, 4C, 5C, you can see 1B, and then these are future fields that we'll have, Lord willing, you know, depending on how all things work out, we hope to be able to grow in here. But, you know, when Alan's telling me, Dad, let's put the kale in, you know, field 1C, 2, 3, I know where it's talking about, right? And he knows what I'm talking. And so you need, and you're flipping stuff. You know, crops are going in, they're coming out. They're going in, they're coming out. So you just need to all be on the same page of where this is going, right? So you're not over preparing a bed somewhere that, oh, no, that's not the bed I meant. I meant this bed. So we have a code that we actually do in regards to how we know what we're thinking. So right now, you can see, we have a total of 96 beds in production. Alan's going to show you a little more about
it. It also helps if you're doing soil testing to really nail down exactly where you're pulling samples from so that you know that the fertility is going to be the same, because sometimes crops are offset from each other as far as when you put them in. And, well, our testing system is fairly intense on our farm, so that just makes it keeping track of where things are at.
Okay, so we'll break this down. Go ahead.
So our fields are broken down into four segments that we call blocks. So block one, block two, block three, block four. And they're all 100 feet long, and they're all 14 and a half feet wide, which means we can put four 30-inch, I think.
I have a slide, yeah. You want me to go to that?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
So four beds. So for instance, this would be, this particular field is 3C, 4. So 3C is a field, 4 is a block number, and then 1, 2, 3, 4. So we can identify down to the level of a bed. on our farm. And I do test, sometimes I do test a single bed at a time, soil test wise. So that just really great. So if I tell Dad, hey, let's pull the spinach out of 3C42, which is where there's spinach right now, yeah. He knows exactly what I'm talking about. And all the fields are set up this way.
Right. So the walkways, they are 18 inches?
18 inches, right. Yeah.
So all the beds are 30 inches wide. That's a very standardized size for market gardens. And the reason you do that is a lot of the tools and a lot of things that you buy and things are scaled for a 30-inch bed.
Also, the average span that someone can comfortably straddle with their feet is 2.5 feet. Tractor farms do 4 feet because it's mechanized, and that's roughly a stance. Now, you can get tractors with wheelbases that are this wide, and we do have one. But that's really where the 4-foot bed comes from. It's not because it's practical. It's because that's how tractors did it.
We do an 18-inch wide path just because it's so much easier to work in than a 12-inch. And 12-inches, some people love 12-inches, but they like 12-inches better than
12-inches.
So, yeah, but 18-inches are just so...
Yeah. Yes, thank you.
And here again, guys, you don't have to follow our exact pattern. But it gives you an idea. I'm not saying this is, and one of the reasons why we went with a smaller lot, we'll show you here in just a second as we standardize. If you're handling certain materials, if you start getting a big enough material, it's hard to maneuver it. And I'll show you here in just a second what I mean.
Okay. All right, so that's that. All right, so what I mean by this, let's go back to this just real quick.
So here's a 30-inch bed right here, bed 4, 30-inch bed. So we have 4 30-inch beds in this house, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay, so no matter what the crop is on our farm, right now how we do it, no matter what the crop is, we're planting in a 30-inch bed. The difference is how many plants you put in the bed and what the spacing is. So this is okra.
Could you go back one, Doug?
Sure.
You can see it in the other one. You can go to that one, actually. All of our irrigation is set up.
I talk about that in a second here. Okay. All right. So we've got okra. Let's say these are 2 foot apart, 2 feet spacing, one plant every 2 foot in the middle of a 30-inch bed. Okay. Very different spacing planting of okra, but that's okra. Carrots. We have 5 rows of carrots in a 30-inch bed. Okay. We'll talk more about that in another talk if you guys decide to join us about how we do carrots and some of the things we've learned about carrots and how we feel like we're finally kind of getting our brain around how to do carrots pretty well. Okay. Cucumbers, right? Everything's in a 30-inch bed. This is some early kale and Swiss chard. Everything's in a 30-inch bed. These are peppers over here in a 30-inch bed. You see how it really frees your mind up about how you just, how you're going in and calculating. Because Alan does almost all of our planning for what we're planting where. And so he knows when he's wanting, I need a 100-foot bed of kale here. He knows exactly how many plants go there.
200.
Right? He just knows it. And so you just know, so when we're going to go to doing seed germination, how many we need to plant, how many, it's just, those are the things that free your mind up. You don't want to be thinking, oh, wait, we're going to put those in that 30-foot bed? Oh, no, that's that 50-foot bed we're doing that. Oh, that bed over there is 36-foot. Oh, this bed's over here. It'll drive you crazy. Your mind just can't manage it all very well. So just whatever bed length you want to do, 30 feet, 50 feet, 20 feet, 100 foot, 200 foot, whatever you think you want to do, just try to standardize it. It'll make your life a lot easier. Okay? Then, lettuce, 3 rows of lettuce. Okay. Now, sure. So next we'll talk about irrigation. And so go ahead, Alan.
So all the irrigation on the farm... Well, we're not quite there yet, but most of it's standardized. And the nice thing about this, is there another picture?
Yeah.
The nice thing about this is that if anything breaks, whether it's this part or going back here.
You've gone down.
Well, that's okay.
Okay.
Or this part, like if a valve breaks, I can pull off of a system that is, let's say, working, that's in place, that's working, and basically keep on without, because you're not all your beds, not all your blocks or fields are at play at the same time. And so if everything's standardized, if anything breaks, you can yank off one and you have time to order it so that you can keep going and you don't get into a bind.
Yeah, beautiful. And keep in mind, so let's say if I was all this lettuce, we have 3 rows of drip tape. This is Toro drip tape. That's Toro. That's the brand name. It's a good brand. If we're going to be, if let's say this bed over here is empty, we can just unscrew that drip tape, pull it up, move it over, pull it back on, connect it, you're good to go. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So you're not trying to roll it up and do all this kind of stuff. We pull it out long, we store it long somewhere, we put a couple sandbags so it doesn't get blown around, and then we undo it and we try to pull it back in and use it again. Okay? Very important. Okay, now this is another type of irrigation.
This is called the DIG 700 series mini sprinklers, and we use these exclusively on crops that we're trying to germinate directly in the field. And the reason that we like this is that it's much lower profile, so in Oklahoma where it's really windy, it doesn't get blown off target, and it also can put out a lot more water. Sometimes the larger overhead systems, the droplet size is bigger, and so when it lands on the soil, sometimes it can smash the soil in and create a crust over the seeds, and it's not as easy for them to come up through it. And so using a lighter, smaller, closer to the ground, not blown off target system is a lot easier when you're starting to germinate things.
Yeah. And then you want to talk about...
And then this is... This is what we use for our overhead systems. We'll use this for hydrocooling during the summertime on crops that are outside. And we also use it for crops that are too tall that they can't fit under the sprinklers, the small sprinklers. And this is called a Hunter MP Rotator. And it also has an extension from walla-walla irrigation. Early in the morning or in the evening to places, and they have those pop-up sprinklers, mm-hmm. and they go around. That's exactly what this is. It's a head for one of those pop-up sprinklers. And the neat thing about these sprinklers is that instead of doing like a 360 throw pattern, you can actually get them to do like 90 to 180 degree throw pattern. So you can, this little piece on the top, you can actually turn that nut and it will actually shorten or widen your spray pattern. So it gives you a lot more control.
Yeah.
And instead of like, I don't know if anyone's familiar with wobblers. They're kind of a thing and it wobbles around and throws it. Those wobblers, they shake their riser that they're on. This one is completely static and steady. There's no shake in the riser, so you don't have to have as heavy of a stake to hold it up. And at the same time, it shoots out a direct spray of water, in so a stream, and then it rotates the pattern like this in a very balanced way, so there's no shaking, unlike wobblers where they have a harder time fighting the wind because it's one single droplet being thrown out at a time. This one's actually a stream, and so they're way more effective in windy climates to actually get your coverage and get things on target.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
How far apart do you place yours?
The question is how far apart... We'll answer this one. That's good. But if you don't mind, hold most of your questions to the end.
Write it down, and then we'll come back to that.
Go ahead. I repeated it. Go ahead and answer.
Oh, okay.
You're being recorded.
So I believe on that one we have 6 over a 20-foot section, so it would be every 20 feet that we space those. You could do tighter, though, if you wanted. And those, you need at least 30 PSI in your system to get them to work. Okay? So a lot of, let's just go back for a second. A lot of these overhead systems, if you are in a very low pressure setup, they won't work. They need at least a minimum of 30 PSI to get enough of a throw pattern, enough energy behind the water to get it to throw the way you want to.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
One thing I want to mention. There's actually a nut in the top of the MP rotators. You can actually twist it with the machine, and it'll actually change the pitch of the throw as well. So they're the best, in my opinion.
For big overhead.
Yeah, for big overhead water. This is a Netafin CoolNet Pro Fogger, and we use this for hydrocooling inside of our tunnels. And we're going to have a whole class where we talk about how we implement these.
Yep.
But we also use this not so much as an irrigation tool, but as to add humidity into the houses. Mm-hmm. During the summer, which might sound counterintuitive, but we'll go into that. And then we use these guys inside the tunnels as well, because there's not a lot of space to really put a riser in there. So we'll hang them up on top of the houses. And Netafim spin net sprinkler, these put out a beautiful spray pattern.
It's so like a nice, gentle rain.
We use these pretty much exclusively inside the houses.
The slide rain for that, and is that the same kind?
No, it's the same company, Netafim, but this is a CoolNet Pro Fogger, and the other one...
Oh,
so that's a fogger. That's more of a real fine, like, mist. Yeah, this is actually a rain, like a raindrop. And the nice thing is that, and here again, keep in mind, the majority of what we use as irrigation on our farm is drip tape. That's what we use the most of.
80%.
Yeah. So we use a lot of drip tape. I mean, that's our go-to drip tape. We like it. It doesn't get the plant. But sometimes in our area in Oklahoma, and I hope you can make it to the growing cooler loving crops in the heat of the South. If you're in the South, it's a good class to come to. If you're attending this class and you're from Minnesota or Washington or something like that, that's probably a class you don't need to come to because you don't deal with those things. You're not dealing with that kind of issue in the summertime like we do down here in the South, right? Here's the issue. Well, we'll get to that when we get to it. But anyway, if you're in the South and you want to try to grow some of these crops more in the summer, then I would encourage you to come to that class. That's so
tomorrow, anyway. First hour?
I don't remember. Okay. Low hoops. So this is actually a really important tool. And you can see we actually have them inside of one of our houses here. We used them a lot. This is what we started with. We had no greenhouses when we first started, or hoop houses, or any kind of structure you could walk in. All we started with initially were these little hoops. And you can pull things over the top. You can pull blankets over the top. You can put nets over the top. You know, all those kind of things. It's a great way. I will tell you, it's very labor intensive. So don't do too many of these, okay? Don't get ahead of yourself. Just do a few of them, see how you like them. But they're real gems inside of a house because once it gets cold, this picture wasn't taken that long ago, okay? And you can see these white sheets here. Those are what's called row cover. At night when we know it's going to be below 30 degrees, we just drape those over the top of these hoops, and it covers them, helps keep heat in there. But these, you want this all standardized. And so what we do is we have, this is a EMP half-inch electric conduit. We buy it like at Lowe's or Home Depot, wherever you want to. And then Alan actually welds on a 3/8-inch rebar about 15 inches long. So we get the whole hoop that is actually right at ground level. Does that make sense? The rebar is what we push into the ground, the whole hoop. Initially, when we first started, we were pushing the hoop down into the dirt.
And it worked because we were using 12-inch walk paths, and so it kept it up high enough. But when we changed to 18-inch, we had to add these extensions on to make it work. So
you want it up higher because, you know, some of your crops come in there and you don't want to... Which one? This one?
Nope, the other one.
That one?
Thank you.
So that's how we just store them when we're not using them. We have a couple of posts out there, and we just lean them up against there. And then as we need them, we pull them back in and get them back in to going. And that's kind of what they look like in the house. And then we just, drape over them as necessary.
That was taken like 5 days ago, that picture.
Yeah. So, okay. But standardize it. That's the key. And then we'll come down to row cover. So this is what a house looks like when it's covered, right? There's the hoops. We pull these blankets over. One of the reasons why we like fit 100 feet and we wouldn't want to go any further than 100
feet. It's not DeWitt.
Oh, is it not DeWitt?
No, it's a different cover. It's called...
Agribon?
No, it's not Agribon. It's in the Deerfield catalog. I can't remember.
Oh, I think John was talking about that too.
Yeah, so it's what John uses. It's not DeWitt. I wouldn't use DeWitt.
But he couldn't remember.
No, he couldn't either.
Remember.
He couldn't remember.
Oh, what's it called?
All right.
It's in the Deerfield catalog. Anyone that's interested here at the Ad Agri booth, there's a free resource section of the booth, and there's hundreds of Deerfield catalogs. You can get it from there.
Just pull it, yeah.
But
the nice thing is that... That's Alan way down there. I'm standing here taking a picture, and it takes two people to cover this. Mm-hmm. If you get it one in, one in, and you just pull them over, and it's pretty good once you get the hang of it. It's pretty easy to do. But very important if you're trying to grow when the temperature's too cold.
And they're all the same.
Okay, and all these
so
are the same.
We can pull it out of one house where we're not using it and put it into another house.
Or use it outside if we need to.
Or use it outside.
And this is what it looks like. This was at our other initial first farm, but those are those hoops. This was our greenhouse. We had these hoops. We had that row cover on top, and the plants were okay underneath there. Okay?
So, but this is another reason why you really want to do it inside of a hoop house instead of outside. Because you can't get to the crop until it
falls out. Sure. Yeah, that's right. But, you start where you start. And you just do what you can as you can. Also, we have DeWitt ground cover. This is... This is something we use, we're using more and more of. This is actually just some little garlic you can see coming up here. That's how we plant our garlic out. And then over here, if you can tell, that's where we took our okra out and kind of cut it over. The okra is the only plant that we clear the field with a chainsaw. So we do. I don't know if anybody else does it. We just go through and just cut them up, and then we go through and get the roots pulled out. But very important, if you're, and here's the thing, it's standardized. These are all 100 feet, okay? And you have to burn these holes in, or you can find places where maybe we'll do it for you. But the thing is that once you have this, these things can last you 8, 10, 12 years. So it's not like you're just burning through this.
Is that actually DeWitt?
That is DeWitt.
That one is DeWitt, yes.
And we use this here. This is the same material, except no holes in it. And that's how, if we have a clean field that we're wanting to tarp, we have nothing planted in it, we'll put this on top of that field. Okay? If we're trying to smother a field, like we're planting in new area, we've never planted in before, we don't use this. We use actually something called a silage tarp. Silage tarp is plastic. It's white on one side and black on the other. Okay? Now this field, we're not trying to smother. We didn't have enough of the other tarps. But these are all standard. Okay? So one of these will cover one block. Okay? Remember the block was like 14 and a half feet wide by 100 feet long? And here's the thing. If you had to, you could do this with one person. We normally do it with two, but I can pull this by myself.
If it doesn't have water on it.
If you had two, if it was twice as wide, right? All of a sudden, it's starting to strain you trying to pull it. So I would, personally, we wouldn't recommend you go any bigger with these. It's just one of those things.
That one is probably 16 by 105. And I will say, as far as places to get this, there's two places. You can either get it from Farmer's Friend, which is obviously here at the conference, and then you can also get it from Jordan Ag Supply. But here's the thing is that Farmer's Friend has actually, they work with the manufacturer that's out of Germany that makes this, and they guarantee 105-foot length on it. Jordan Ag Supply can be with anywhere within 5% of the dimensions that they give you, which is really pathetic, in my opinion. So, like, if you're trying, it's cheaper from Jordan Ag Supply, but if you buy a long roll and you're thinking you're going to cut it up into the size that you want and it's 5% too short, you've just lost a whole sheet that you can't use. And so I've stopped buying it from them and I just go with Farmer's Friend.
This is what happens when you pick a field and you walk away from it for like a month and you don't do this to it. Mm-hmm. Then you come back and you have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. This is a huge learning experience. We try to never let anything like that happen again. That's a nightmare. Okay? And you keep saying, like, I'm going to get to it. Prioritize getting them covered. If you're not planting in them, get them covered. Because all we have to do now is just pull this back.
You're ready.
And put your amendments in, all those type of things, and you're just ready to roll. Yeah, it's beautiful. Okay, so number five, infrastructure. All right, so seed house. Seed house is really, we'll go into this a little more in a talk that we have called Grow Better, Not Bigger. But the seed house experience is really, really critical to what you want to have good starts. If you don't have good starts, you're kind of behind the curve. You got to get good starts, right? There's kind of a pecking order. So all this was all hand seeded, right? And we'll talk about a little bit about the germination process in another talk, but you just want to make sure to get that nailed down. And it took us a few years and a few different soil mixes and different things until we finally feel like we have one that we really is a go-to mix, mm-hmm. right? Okay, walk and pack house. I'm going to show you here. This is a little video.
Spacebar.
This is our, is it that or the enter? There we go. Okay. So this is what our walk and pack house looks like. So we come in. This is where we start processing things. We have a table here with like a net on it. We have a nice sprayer handle. That's where we wash a lot of root crops and things of this nature. This is a big tank that we do a lot of our lettuce heads and lettuce mix and everything in. Then we have three different sinks here where we'll wash some other things.
And so that's all of our kind of wash side. You come in to the left, that's then you come back over to the right, and this is where on some of the things that we weigh out and we bag, we do there on the right side. But it's, you can see it's kind of all open, and then we have a walk-in cooler right down here. And so once it's all then pressed, you boom, open the door,
and you pop it in. So
ta-da!
We, on that farm tour that we went on, remember earlier we were showing you all the different farms? Mm-hmm. We were looking at everybody's wash houses. And believe it or not, the wash house we liked the most was Luke Fisher's wash house. And we didn't show you his farm because we didn't do it on that. But Luke's is very similar in that he has this nice big open area. The only thing permanent in there is this table here, back here. Because then we take and we rearrange those tables to bring out the orders, to pack people's orders. And then we set up like a little, you know,
Assembly line.
So we bring them out, we put it in a big U-shape, and we just go through, fill the orders, put it back in the cooler until we're ready to go to market. And we don't have time to talk about our market plan, but it's just, we love the flexibility of that space.
Open space.
So we can open those doors when it's 105 degrees outside in the summer. We can pull our car in the shade. We can load the car in the shade, you know, and just get everything out, and then off you go. So it gives you a lot of flexibility. I would just say
the rule of thumb is try to work all your main non-movable work pieces on the perimeter of the room and keep the center open.
And here's another reason why infrastructure is important. Okay? If you live in this part of the world, you realize hail is a possibility. Okay?
Unfortunately, it's a win.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we generally will get hail probably a couple times a year. So when it's that time of season, if you don't have things covered, one hailstorm can take you out, at least for a few weeks. You don't like that. I don't like that. I don't like that feeling, you know? When a storm's moving in, I like to feel like, okay, no, we can't take a tornado. No, we're not going to take a tornado. But we can take most of the wind, most of the hail. But you got to think. You got to build your infrastructure for your area of what you think you're going to be dealing with. If you're in an area where you don't deal with that, then you don't have to worry about it. But for us, this is something that is not going to go away, right? It's just not going to go away. Just to show you, this is one of our structures. This is kind of our first, not this particular building, but this is kind of our most popular little house we have on the farm. And we're going to talk about these little tarps that we have on there at another talk. But so you can see the four beds there. And then this is kind of what it looks like. In one of the houses. And then this is a new structure that Alan has been working on. This is mostly a welded house, and it's a much more heavy-duty house, and it has higher sides on it, and it's just better designed in the future for a kind of the direction we hope to be going.
2 years ago, we had a big windstorm come through and basically flatten 80% of our houses.
It was, it wasn't flat, but they were flat enough that they were
ruined.
They were ruined.
Your greenhouses.
Yeah, like these houses here.
Yeah,
like that. Like
they're
one just, of those.
They're not engineered super well. But
we don't know for sure what happened. It was 1 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. and it was on a day that we weren't even forecasted to have severe weather.
Infrastructure is a compromise because it's like, do you overbuild like? It's a bit of a catch 22 where you can really over engineer to start out with and put a lot of your capital into the house, or you can build somewhat decent houses and get the experience and not have so much. So it's a yeah.
Okay, so this is a really good quote, and this is kind of back to our thing, but good judgment comes from experience, and a lot of that comes from bad judgment, right? And you will learn that more probably from starting a market garden than maybe from anything else you'll ever do in your life. Maybe. I mean, for us, it's been right there at the top of our list. And so this is like where we kind of want to wrap things up. Because if you are expecting this, you're not going to be very happy through this process. And it probably won't last very long. But if you're expecting this, right, then you kind of look at failure through a different lens. And looking at that failure through a different lens is really critical because you'll have plenty of times to do that, unfortunately. But coming to things like this helps really shorten that that experience and maybe helps you just avoid it. Yeah, just maybe helps you avoid a lot of it all because you'll have plenty on your own. Okay, you'll have plenty on your own.
I just wanted to mention, there is a guy that's been pretty influential in my journey in agriculture. His name's Bill Brush. He's out of Fresno, California.
Yeah.
And he's been farming for years. His family, he grew up as a farmer. His dad was a big farmer and all these types of things. And he talks about how it's kind of like the idea of, let's say that you're looking for a $100 bill and you have 20 bags on the ground. And $100 is in one of those bags. So you could either pick up the right bag first and open it and find the $100 bill, and that's all you need to do. You found it. Or you might have to go through 15 bags before you find the $100 bill, or you might have to go through all 20 before you find the $100 bill. The idea is that farming is the aspect of keeping on looking to find the $100 bill. But the thing is that each one of those bags is a part of the puzzle to get to where you want to go. And so, like Dad said, coming to these events, even though you're going to make plenty of mistakes on your own, if you can anticipate bags that other people have opened and add that to your collection, then that's a bag that you don't need to open, that you don't have to pay the price to open. And if you can implement it and learn, I think, what's that? There's that quote, like, none of us live long enough to learn everything on our own. We have to learn from others. So that's why these events are so valuable. It's to say, okay, what are the bags that you've opened? How can I not have to open them? But then you're going to have a few of your own unique bags that are unique to your environment that then you're going to have to learn on your own. And then you'll come back and share them with us.
That's right.
We don't have to.
And just one thing about what he just said, and I should have started with this, because here's one of the best, I think one of the best things that have been shared with us. We were in Bellingham, Washington. Okay, if you know where Bellingham, Washington is, it's north of Seattle, almost to Canada. It's near the coast. You see what I'm saying? Up there in Washington State, that we visited a farm up there called Joe's Garden.
Beautiful.
And it's a beautiful farm, beautiful location, just beautiful. And that farm's been there years and years and years and years. The guy who, one of the brothers who owns that farm, his name is Jason. And he was very, very judicious. I mean, he spent a lot of time with us. More time. We didn't have an appointment, nothing. We just showed up and he just came and just started walking us around, showing everything. And then towards the end, he goes, you know, probably the best advice I could give you. Of course, I'd like to know the best advice you could give me, right? And I said, what? He goes, you know, I do a lot of things here that work here, in this area, in this environment, at this location. But he goes, what you really need to do is you need to find somebody who's in your area, who's doing well, and try to learn as much as you can from them. And keep that in mind. It's very, very critical because we got back home and we started talking. We said, we loved how he did a lot of his irrigation up there, right? And we kind of racked our brains. How could we do this here? And we came to realize we can't do that here. It won't work here. We have too many other issues that we have to be dealing with to just do it like he does it. But there's things he's doing there that we can learn from. The key is knowing what you can take and implement where you're at and what you just need to forget about. Because what they're doing there will maybe never work for you where you're at. So when you read a book or when you come to hear a presentation on agriculture, you got to have that filter, right? Because you don't want to go too far down this path until you feel like it can work for you where you're at. And it's not just this carbon copy blueprint that is for everybody and it works the same way for everybody. It doesn't. It just doesn't. And so, you know, we'll be talking about stuff that we deal with that you might never have to deal with, right? And sure, there's things that you're dealing with that we don't have to deal with. So anyway, let's open it up for any kind of questions if anybody has any. Yes, ma'am. Yes, 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 yes.
How coincidental.
Well, your ma'am. That's Olita, because I know Olita. Your ma'am, sorry.
Can you go back to the very last number 4 standardized slide?
Maybe.
Standardized.
The standardized?
Like the fields?
The very last one.
Yeah, that one?
I think that's it.
Yeah, okay. You bet. Hold it.
My question is that you were saying you weren't happy with your soil starting mix that you used and that you were working on that. Is that something you can share?
The question is, can we share our soil mix recipe?
Yes. I will warn you, though, that it's fairly involved, and that's why we were hesitant to share it. So if you're serious about it, I'm happy to share it with you. But I have probably like 12 different ingredients that aren't as intuitive to source. I can't say, oh, go here and buy this mix and just add it. It's like, okay, you're going to have to source from this company, and then 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 weigh it out, and then buy a scale. And it's a little more involved, but it works well.
And the initial thing he's talking about is a bit overwhelming. But once you have it, it's not overwhelming at all. I mean, to mix it up, once you have it and you know what you're doing, it's like it just becomes very straightforward. So, yes. Chris, yes.
So you all collected the strips,
a smaller soil block? Smaller soil block.
Yeah, the question is about our soil blocks for our starts.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we use a soil block maker, and then we talk more about that in another class.
Yeah.
But
have you all elected to do that for a certain reason?
I've used the wind strips.
Yeah.
I don't really like them, but some people like them. What I would suggest is get a small soil block maker and try it out and get a few wind strips and try them out and see what works for you. I don't like them.
So,
I mean,
a lot of it's preference.
And those are smaller, like, are those smaller?
Well, okay, so
these are,
so a few reasons, in my opinion, against.
Repeat
the okay, question. So the idea is there's a company that makes a seedling tray. It's called a wind strip. And basically the idea is that it has air gaps on two sides of the cells of each cell wall. And the idea is that if you grow in a regular cell tray, it doesn't have these air gaps on either side of the cell. So when a plant stays in the tray too long, it'll start becoming root bound. And so the idea is to create an air gap so that the roots won't start circulating in the tray. But they don't have bigger or smaller, it's just a standardized size. So number one, with soil blocks, I have three different types of soil blockers, and each of them are different because I don't usually fertilize my seedlings after I seed them. And so there's a dynamic there where depending on the type of seedling I'm trying to do, I'll use a different size. So I like the variability of size that the soil blocks gives me. It also gives me the root pruning aspect. I also like the aspect of handling in the field because with the soil blocks, I can put my hand right under, pull up all the things, and then just drop them down with this. I'm having to deal with the tray in the field. Also, soil volume is much greater with soil blocks than wind strips because you're not packing it into a form like a soil block would. You're putting them in. You could pack them down. I do also like the aspect of the soil blocks where it automatically dibbles the top of the tray. I think you could make a dibbler for a wind strip tray, but between the variability of sizes and already pre-packaging, I know the downside of soil blocking is the physical aspect of mixing the water into the mix.
It's more labor.
And it's more labor intensive. But what I would say about that is that as we scale up, there are small automated commercial units for soil blocking where basically it will mix it for you, popper it up into a thing, and then it'll just hammer them out. And you can actually have a seed drop on the top. So as the seeds come out, it'll actually direct seed into the tops of the soil blocks and then cover it. So if you're going to size up, if you are going to size up, you can get these machines. They are a European design, but if you get to a size where this is getting too much for you, it would make economic sense to just get a...
I think a lot depends on where you're at, what's your physical ability?
Yes.
So, you know, you just have to, it's, and then what's your preference and things of this nature? I mean, so
I use the wind strips, but there's things about them I don't think
you can. So, I mean, there's going to be things you probably don't like about whatever method you go with. I mean, honestly, but you know, it would be nice if, and I'm not, people who don't have the physical ability to hammer out these, because it's physical.
I mean, I do the soil block.
There's some physical. Yeah. I mean, I help some, but he's the one who does primary, a lot of it. And so, anyway, let's
this guy back here.
Yes.
Has been waiting for a while.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so I'm potentially going to irrigate from gravity with very low pressure. So speak to low pressure and drip tape. What are the parameters on pressure?
Right, so the question?
Yeah, so the question is that you have a low pressure system, and so you're wanting to know what the parameters are for drip tape. So drip tape is obviously the best for low pressure. You need to have at least 5 to 10 PSI. It depends on the drip tape. So each drip tape will give its specifications.
Oh,
So if you want to come by the booth later, we can walk through a Deerfield catalog and I can show you the different drip tapes and specs. Usually, with low pressure systems as well, you're going to want to have a higher bigger pipes because you don't have the force to push it through smaller pipes. You could also, I'm guessing is this an off-grid setup? Or do you have electrical there that you can?
I'm just wondering, the lower I can work with, less infrastructure I have to, I have to create the pressure.
Right. I mean, there's step-up pumps that you can get that are, like, for instance, you could go to Tractor Supply. I don't know if you have Tractor Supplies in your area, and you could spend $300 and get a 40 PSI pump that puts out 30 GPMs a minute, and it runs off of just, like, a regular house core that plugs into a wall. So, and actually, we irrigate our entire farm, acre, off of that one pump right now. And so it's a $300 investment. And we basically, if you were to put it, let's say, onto your tank, let's just say, you could bleed off a little bit of water back into your tank so that that pump can, we just leave the pump on all day. We don't have a pressure switch. We don't have anything like that. So it's actually, if you want to add some pressure to your system and you have electricity and you're not off grid, it's a very low cost, $300, and it also means that you can use smaller pipes, which is a cost savings, and you can irrigate more at one time if you're trying to irrigate more. So for a $300 investment, it's
something to consider.
And it gives you overhead options as well.
Yes, question back here in the back. Yeah.
You could use that. The thing is that what happens when you want to put something, I mean, it depends on how intensive you're wanting to do your operation, because the thing is that, let's say, that straw is not all going to rot down in a single season, so you're going to have to deal with that, taking it off, because if you're going to come back and, let's say, seed carrots, now you have all this junk in your field. It's not junk, but it's kind of like weeds. Weeds are just plants out of place. So we call them weeds because they're not where we want them. Straw, when it's where you want it to be, it's great. When it's not where you want it to be, you're going to have to rake that out and get all that out of your field. So, like, we don't like that. We like the tarps because they do have a long-lasting lifespan, and it also gives us the ability to just completely just pull out the stakes and take it off without having to rake and deal with a lot of material. So if you're wanting to, let's say, add organic matter, I just add peat moss to your field. It's probably going to last longer than the hay anyways, and you're not going to have to deal with all this straw that would get in the way of a cedar, let's say.
Was the straw, well, does that help at all?
Yeah, that helps.
Okay, so any other questions?
Long term, like you could leave it there for a year.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to leave it a long time, then that works. If you're going to be switching, like us, 2 to 3 crops per season, per square foot per year.
Okay, let's do a couple more and we'll call it. Yes. Is the soil mix that we use designed for the soil block?
Yes. But it could be used. It could be used. I mean, there's.
I mean, we use it.
The base is peat and perlite. We're not like Coleman's mix. He adds in soil, or he'll add in a compost. We don't have a compost addition to our mix. The difficult part of our mix isn't the peat moss and the perlite. It's the nutrient blend that's added to it that becomes a little bit more technical. So, and difficult to source.
But once you source it, it's not that difficult to source.
Right.
It's just the idea, like, where do you get it from your neighborhood or in your neck of the woods? We know where we get it, but, right, so that's where it gets kind of tricky. Yes? So the question is about having a well or water production that yields at least 25 gallons per minute, and why that we felt like that number was important. Did you want to talk?
Yeah, so the 25 gallons per acre per minute, that's the metric that it's compared to, is if someone, a lot of times systems that are designed for an acre, especially when you go to like more of a commercial setting, they're basically saying, this is how much water you need to acre this much land if you're running it 24/7 to actually cover that area, which in a commercial area that could work. But if you have a breakdown, if a pump goes down, if you have a leak, if, you know, whatever these things that can affect your system and you need to replace something or repair something, now you're behind the eight ball and a crop still needs to be watered. And especially in the summertime, you need to design your system for the most likely case at the most extreme time of the year. Because you don't want, I mean, an irrigation system that's less than that, it might work up till June. But once July and August hit, like this last year in Texas and Oklahoma, where we were hitting 104, 110, 111 degrees at 24% humidity, the water is just being baked off the ground really fast. So you have to have an irrigation system that can keep up with that demand. And if there is any kind of breakdown in your system where you need to do a repair, that you have enough volume to pick back up and make sure that you can cover yourself. Because if this is your livelihood, you need to build in some resilience into that system.
And you know, probably depends on where you're located. I don't know where you live. Southern California. So
for you...
So you guys are getting plenty of rain in Southern California. No, I don't know. Right?
So for you, that even might be more critical dynamic. I know some people say, you know, 10 gallons per minute per acre, like that's probably on the lower end. But for me, I really want to have that buffer because things happen. If it can't happen, it will happen usually.
Yeah. Okay, one more question or we can call it. Okay, yes, right here. Have we ever used coconut choir?
Next question.
No, we haven't.
No.
We will take one more, though.
Yeah, just wondering, you use a deep well pump to the water, then you use a different pump?
The question is that when we get the water, do we use one pump to get the water out, and we use another pump to actually irrigate?
Right. So that's an interesting question. Where we are right now, our water is within 15 feet of the surface, and we can pump up to about 100 gallons a minute. So we have a really good water source because we're in an alluvial aquifer, but in some places your well might be 400, 500 feet deep. And so the thing is that every 2.32 feet is 1 PSI. So if you're 400 and some feet deep, you're going to have a massive pump to basically pull up and get it out, and then to have enough pressure then to actually give you 30 PSI on top of that, you're talking about a lot of cost. So some people will divide the system, and they'll get a smaller pump that runs all the time into like some sort of cistern or lake or something like that, and then they'll use an above-ground pump to pump out of that cistern to give the flow and pressure to go the rest of the way. Because sometimes it is expensive to buy a pump that can do both of those all at one time. So you'll just have to, it's a kind of a toggle between, you know, spending a lot of money for a deep well pump to get it up to the surface, because it's a pressure versus volume dynamic. Once you're at the surface, you don't have to have as much pressure because you're already where you want to be to get the water to, so it's more of transporting it across versus up. So that's going to be, I mean, what I would do is, ask your person that is drilling your well and ask them, because usually a well driller will also install a pump. I mean, technically speaking, it's almost unless you have a crane and a winch and stuff, it's really hard to install your own pump when it's that far down in the ground because there's so much pipe and water. To replace it, you almost have to have a person with a crane to come and lift it out.
But we're not sure how deep his well is.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, I think about...
Okay.
460. What is the water volume? Did they say
50 gallons?
50 gallons a minute. That's going to be an expensive pump. If you're
going to.
Okay, but for a house, you only need like 10 gallons a minute. So usually, an irrigation pump and a house pump would be a different spec. Yeah. Yeah, it can get pricey when you're pulling up. So. You know, you gotta have, you know, in the area that you're pulling from. Of course, you're in Tennessee, right? Yeah, so the water demands, it's gonna be a little different because we get 34 inches a year, you get about 64 inches a year. So that's gonna play into that calculus too.
Thank you so much for coming.
Talk more about this.
Hopefully, if you can make it this afternoon, I think we have another talk this afternoon.
Is it the next hour?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's grow bigger. No, grow better, not bigger. So hopefully you can make it back to that. See you. Enjoy lunch. Thanks for coming.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.